All right, thank you. And for those of you who wish to go, you're dismissed. That's fine. And we can, the rest of us, who if you want to stick around, you don't have to ask questions that are up here. You can ask whatever you like. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, well, you have water there right from the beginning. It's very interesting. Even in verse 2, it says, the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the deep. And there's mention of water. 2 Peter 3, Peter talks about you've got a microphone. Okay, all right. I think everybody heard that question, but I can repeat it as well if it's quiet. 2 Peter mentions the earth being created out of water and by water, and then by water it was deluged and destroyed. He's referring, of course, to the flood. There is a lot of mention of water associated with the early stages of creation. And some creationists have suggested that originally the material that God created, out of which he fashioned the earth and all of the heavenly bodies that we see today, was water. Ordinary, plain, liquid water. That seems to be what the Bible is suggesting. It mentions water, and if you look at the Hebrew, the nuances of the Hebrew, it's just ordinary water. It's not frozen water, it's not water vapor, it's not steam, it's water. It's just ordinary water. And so water seems to figure in quite prominently in the early stages of creation, the first few days. Land was created on day 3. Water came first, then came land, and then plants sprung up on that same day, on day 3. So land and plants on the same day. Any other questions? Yes.
One of the arguments for the gap theory is that the earth was without form and void, the Bible tells us, and the argument is God doesn't create things that are formless and void. You know that if it's formless and void, it must have been a result of something other than God's creation. How do you respond to that argument?
You can, and there's great stuff. Actually, there's a chapter in the Creation Answers book on the gap theory, and formless and void. Yes, you can. It doesn't go one way or the other, really. You've mentioned something that other people have brought up. Well, if it was formless and void, that means there used to be something there. Well, imagine if you open your laptop and you open a Word document, you're about to type something. The document, before you type anything, it's void, isn't it? It's formless and void. You've got nothing there. Or you could type a number of paragraphs and you could delete it. And after you've deleted it, it's formless and void. How could you tell the difference? Both of the formless and void could refer to God hasn't done anything with the matter yet, or it could refer to what you suggested, what you've heard from others, that formless and void meant that absolutely there must have been something before. But it doesn't absolutely mean that. It could mean, and as I just illustrated, it could mean that God hasn't done anything with the matter that was there at the beginning. And I think that's the position to take, to interpret it, to add to it and say, well, that means that there was something else before, and then to try to speculate on that. You're really reading things into the Bible with that particular view. If it's formless and void, the default position should be there hasn't been anything done with it yet. That's why it's formless and void. So you can take that two ways, right? Other questions? There's one at the back there. Yes.
The millions of years was a fear that seemingly good meaning churchmen thought would discredit the faith. What is parallel to that in these days? Like, is there something that kind of, like, I know there's a lot of different things that you're showing scientifically, but is there something prominent that, much like a number of years ago, millions of years was something that they just, it totally discredited the faith as far as what men that didn't take the Bible as it said. Can you understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to say, is there something somewhat parallel to those millions of years that now is getting answered, at least for those who want to have ears to hear?
Okay.
Is there something else somewhat similar to that, that in this day and age it's growing in a fearsome way that people are almost scared to hold with the scriptural
Okay, so just so that I understand
yeah,
you, years ago, the millions of years was seen as something scientifically reputable. And
yeah, like in
the like
1800s, there was somebody that came out and said, hey, you got to put this million years
in somewhere. We've got to put it in there, yeah.
And is there something that nowadays you see going through many churches that maybe is similar to that fairly significant fact?
I would say it's things like the new perspective on Paul and postmodernism. Postmodernism is very difficult to define, but postmodernism means that you can't know the truth for sure, and that has crept into the church in the emergent church movement. Now the emergent church movement is not that new; it's been around for a number of years, but it's really an offshoot of. It's the secular postmodernism that's been applied to Christianity. We can't know God for sure. We can't know any meaning from Scripture for sure. I think that's very dangerous. Regarding the effect that it's having on the church, I don't think it's having anywhere near the effect that in the 18 and early 1900s the notion of millions of years has had, and to a large degree today. Conservative Bible scholars and conservative Christian thinkers that you have everywhere, they generally reject postmodernism. Now, it's not popular in a postmodern society for a pastor to stand up and say, I know what God says, and I know what He says for sure. That's not popular, and yet that is what we can do. As believers, we have the Word of God plainly written there, and we can know for sure what God expects of us, and we can know for sure how to be saved. That's not postmodern, and that's what the emergent church is fighting against. Well, that's one version of Christianity, and you can have different versions of Christianity and so on. So that's as far as were you thinking within the creation evolution or about Genesis or just in general? Okay, all right. Yeah, that's my guess. The new perspective on Paul, and Paul didn't really understand what he was talking about, and things like that. Quite damaging, but in a smaller way than the millions of years was. Yes, the 14. Okay, how did the different skin colors arise? Yeah, that's a popular question. I think I mentioned this a couple of days ago. All nations on earth go back through... Yeah, this would have been on Thursday night. All nations on earth go back through the Tower of Babel, back to Noah, and originally back to Adam. So how come there's people with different shades of skin? Good question. Adam and Eve probably had middle brown skin. In fact, there's a back issue of the magazine at the back there that we wrote an article on this. On the front page of a front cover of the magazine, there's a couple of twin girls. I don't have a copy of it here, but I know that it is back on the table. A couple of twin girls. One is blonde hair, blue eyes, light skin. The other one is dark hair, dark eyes, dark skin. And they're twins. Twin girls. And you look at the article in the magazine, their parents have middle brown skin. Most of the world has middle brown skin anyways. From a middle brown couple, you can have the whole range of skin tones. Now, how do we get the distribution of light-skinned people and dark-skinned people after the Tower of Babel? The Tower of Babel, if you've taken biology at perhaps like high school or beyond, you'll recognize that as the founder effect or the founder principle. If you have a population of living things, people in this case, and you break them up into smaller groups that only mix within themselves, changes can come out in those little groups very, very quickly in only a few generations. Now, so how does that relate to skin color? All of us have a pigment in our skin called melanin. And it's the same pigment. There's two different types of it. There's a brownish type and a reddish type. And it depends on how much of that pigment you have in your skin that controls the shade of your skin. If we want to be really accurate, there are no skin colors. It's all the same color. It's just a different shade of the same color. And everyone has melanin. Like, people say, I'm white. I'm not white. What's white? This is sort of white here. If my skin looked like this, I'd be dead, right? I'm light brown, like most of you, right? I have some melanin in my skin. We all have melanin in our skin, unless you're albino, and then there's a mutation that that eliminates the production of melanin. But everybody has melanin in their skin. And so how do we get this distribution? It's important for sunlight to penetrate your skin to help process vitamin D. That's healthy. In fact, Canadians should be, and the Canada Health folks last year, they made an official announcement, Canadians should be supplementing their diet with vitamin D in, you know, January, February, that type of thing. We're not getting enough sunshine on our skin. We've got warm clothes when we're outside and so on. And so in a... If you imagine the group of people that moves from the Middle East, from Babel, where Babel was, northward into Europe, into England perhaps, it's colder, it's like Canada, you're going to wear thicker clothes for large portions of the year, you're not going to get that much sunlight on your skin. So in that part of the world, it would be advantageous for the people with the genetic instructions for a little bit of pigment, a little bit of melanin, like me. I've got a little bit of melanin in my skin. And then any sunlight that I do get on my skin is good. It's absorbed and vitamin D is produced and I'm in good shape. However, so after a while, the people in that part of the world with the information for lots of pigment, they wouldn't be as healthy, wouldn't leave as many kids. And after a while, all you have in that part of the world, north of Babel, colder climate, are people with the genetic information for a little bit of pigment. The ancient Europeans. Now, the opposite happens with the group that moves southward into North Africa and so on. There, it's hot. You're not going to wear thick clothes all the time. You're going to get a lot of sunlight on exposed skin. You don't want too much of it because then you get skin cancer and die. But so you want to limit the amount of sunlight. So it's advantageous in that part of the world for the people with the information for lots of pigment. You limit the amount of sunlight that penetrates the skin. And that's healthy. That's good in that environment. So that's how you get the distribution of skin colors. Noah and his family and then Adam before him, they were probably middle brown. You can't get from a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Adam and a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Eve, you can't get the darker skin colors. And the opposite way is true as well. Adam and Eve, I've seen, you know, some children Bibles, right? They've got Adam as a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, Caucasian. That's not terribly accurate, but I haven't seen, but I've heard of Bibles where every person depicted in the Bible, all the pictures in the Bible, including Jesus and the apostles, are black. That's not accurate either, but they were probably middle brown. And from there, understanding biblical history and a little basic biology, the founder principle and so on, you can get the distribution of skin colors. And then we've got articles like that one in Creation Magazine where you've got a middle brown couple and both the dad and the mom's mothers were white and both their fathers were black. They had middle brown skin and now they've got these twin girls, one's white, one's black. Genetically, that's simple genetics, right? You've got the information in the grandparents for both white skin and dark skin. In their parents, it's middle brown skin, but the genetic information is all there in mom and dad for very light skin and very dark skin. And so it just manifested. Most of their kids are going to be middle brown, but it just happened that way in these twins. So it's actually easy to explain. Now, the evolutionists, let's just continue on a little bit. I know there's other questions. The evolutionists, how do they explain skin color? This is fascinating. Darwin, in his books that he wrote after the Origin of Species, The Descent of Man, for example, he wrote that book. And then he talks about human evolution. And he says, well, you see, well, since he was a white man from England, he said the white people have evolved the fastest. So they're the furthest away from the animals. But people with very, very dark skin, like the Australian Aborigines, some of the darkest skin in the world, almost black skin, they haven't evolved very fast, you see. So they're still closer to the animals. And in some places in the 1800s, there'd be people who would go to Australia and they'd shoot every Aboriginal that they came to. They'd line up across areas of the state and they'd shoot every Aboriginal. So they're never going to understand white man technology. Amazing how with the growing acceptance of evolution in the 1800s, racism went through the roof. It's just amazing if you classify people like that. Whereas you look at what the Bible says, there's one race. How do you get racism from that? We all go back to Noah. We're all brothers and sisters, ultimately. But teach that in the public education system. And, you know, if people start thinking properly about where we all came from, maybe we wouldn't have some of these problems that we have. Other questions? The clock for radioisotope dating, the only types of rocks that you can date are igneous rocks.
I just said it.
You all remember your three types of rocks from high school? No? You've got igneous rocks, sedimentary rocks, and metamorphic rocks, right? The sedimentary rocks are the ones that are laid down by water and contain fossils. Igneous rocks are rocks that were once molten. Those are the only rocks that evolutionists can use for radioisotope dating. And the clock begins when the rock cools. Yes, absolutely. The rock comes out of the ground. It's molten. It's molten rock. And the clock starts when that rock gets to the surface and cools. Because at that point, it'll capture something that's radioactive. And over time, that radioactive element, rubidium, potassium, argon, something like that, it'll decay over time into something that's not radioactive, that's stable. And that's how the data, that's what the dating method starts with. You measure the amounts of those two isotopes in the rock, and then you can calculate an age. But the clocks begin, that's an important point, the clocks begin when the rocks cool and solidify. Otherwise, all the rocks would have the same age, right? They're all coming from inside the Earth, but the clock begins on that particular dating method when the rock cools and solidifies. Other questions? Maybe we'll have maybe just one or two more, and then I think we'll cut it off.
That question you had the other night, I don't know if you answered it, about the kangaroos, how they ended up over in Australia.
Yeah. Good question. The ark lands in the Middle East. Kangaroos, two by two, get off the ark. How in the world did they get to Australia? Australia is an island nation. We'll say more about this tomorrow night. Creationists believe that there was one continent originally. It broke up rapidly during the flood. So imagine no Atlantic Ocean before the flood. Okay, and that's. Have you heard of Pangaea? Anybody heard that terminology? Yeah, that the evolutionists have sort of taken over that term. So that's not a term we use. But that's what we'll be talking about tomorrow night. Not the slow and gradual opening up of the Atlantic Ocean over millions of years, but a rapid movement of the continental plates and the ocean plates as well, the rock underneath the ocean. So there's all kinds of things that went on during the flood leading to, and some of you might be saying, that's how it happened. So this process, the kangaroos were on Australia, and then Australia moved to become an island. That's not quite it. After the flood, Australia was in the position we see it today. So that's a real question. How did the kangaroo get there? All of those processes would have generated a tremendous amount of heat. The water in the oceans after the flood would have been a lot warmer than they are today. If Noah, getting off the ark, would have had a thermometer, the oceans would be a lot warmer. So you're building up the conditions necessary for a global ice age. That's what a flood would do. You need three conditions on the surface of the Earth to get an ice age. I'll get around to your question. You're thinking, well, where's he going with this? We're getting there. Let's talk about an ice age. More evaporation, more snowfall, and cooler summers. That's what you need to get an ice age. And a flood would produce those three conditions. How? You've got movement of the plates, you've got volcanism, volcanoes on a massive, almost incomprehensible scale. Tsunamis that make Japan look like a kiddie pool. It's unbelievably catastrophic. And we'll talk about that tomorrow night. You've got to come back tomorrow night. So you've got a lot of heat generated during the flood. After the flood, the ocean water is going to be warmer. That's the first condition met, more evaporation. The oceans after the flood are pumping moisture into the atmosphere because the water's warmer. Warmer water evaporates more readily than cold water, right? That's why our hair dryers blow hot air instead of cold air. And then because of the volcanism, because of the volcanoes putting dust and pollutants into the atmosphere, you shield out some of the sun's energy, making the continents cooler. More evaporation from the oceans, more snowfall on the continents, especially in the higher latitudes, further north and further south, and cooler summers. Perfect conditions for an ice age. And the ice age would have lowered the ocean level by 400 to 500 feet, something like that. You're taking huge amounts of water out of the ocean, dumping it on land in these kilometer-thick glaciers that then, under the tremendous weight of all that ice, they scour the landscape and they pulverize rocks and so on. And we see the evidence of that in this part of Canada. This part of Canada was at one time covered with these glaciers. They went down some distance into the States, but Mexico has never seen a glacier. An ice age doesn't mean that the entire world is covered with ice. It just means that the glaciers at the poles grow, and then they shrink back toward the end of the ice age. So the ice age probably lasted somewhere around 700 years, maybe peaking at 500 years and then tailing off for a couple hundred years. So the ice age would have taken a lot of water out of the oceans, dumped it on land, lowered ocean levels by 400 to 500 feet, it's estimated. Today, if you lower the ocean level by only 200 feet, all of the continents, including Australia, are connected by land. So how did the kangaroo get to Australia? It hopped. The ice age happened after the flood, as people and animals were repopulating the earth, and after Babel especially, people were scattering across the earth during the ice age. Now, around the equator, they could have traveled in boats. That's a possibility for the distribution of people and animals after the flood. Maybe some people sailed to Australia. I mean, no one knew how to build a boat. People probably knew how to build boats. And when they couldn't understand that group over there and that group over there, and they were backed up against the ocean, they probably said, well, we're taking off. We're going to discover Australia or something. And they became the aboriginals there after the flood. Or they sailed to South America and they became the ancient Aztecs and Incas that we know about today. But there you have, there's a notion for how we distribute people and animals and kangaroos to places like Australia. It's tied in with the Ice Age, and we'll say more about that tomorrow night. Let's do one more, and then I think we do need to cut it off. But I'll be available afterwards, so you can... we've got one here. I know there's
more. How
can
we see light from distant galaxies?
How can we see light from distant galaxies? You weren't here last night, were you? You know what? It's. I'll explain this briefly, and then I'll refer you to creation.com. You type in starlight and time on the search engine, and you can get all the technical information you want. The reason it's a little more technical, because the explanation that I prefer involves relativity. Einstein's relativity. And as soon as you mention Einstein, you know things are going to get hairy, right? In Einstein's first, in his special theory of relativity, he talked about the effect of velocity on time. The faster you go, the slower time gets. In his general theory, published a number of years later, he included the effects of gravity on time. In a stronger gravitational field, time slows down. Mind-bending stuff all by itself. You'll be up late tonight thinking about how that's possible. But it is. It's very possible. I gave an example last night of the GPS satellites and so on. The GPS satellites are in a lesser gravitational field. The clocks on those satellites have to be tuned so that they run slower to run at the same rate as the clocks in your GPSs in your car. Otherwise, as soon as you flick on your GPS and put in where you want to go, for every minute, it would be off by 400 meters. More, it would be further and further off the longer your GPS is on, because the clocks are out of synchronization. And so Einstein, as bizarre as that notion says, Einstein was right. Gravity affects time. Now, the Bible says that in quite a number of places that God stretched out the heavens like a tent or like a curtain, even implying a fabric to space. And that is very interesting to astrophysicists, a fabric to space. But if God stretched out the heavens, that means that before that, everything was closer together, before the stretching, right? So now you have to take into account the effects of gravitational time dilation, what Einstein talked about there. And if the Earth is near the center of all the or much of the matter that we see today in through our telescopes, then there's going to be a lot of gravity here. Relative to the gravity way out here where there's very little matter. So it's possible that while minutes or seconds tick by on Earth, millions or billions of years elapse at the edge of the universe, plenty of time to allow the light from those galaxies to get to Earth, so that on day six, when the sun goes down and Adam and Eve look up at the night sky, they see approximately the same night sky that we see today. So I'm going to end it there. I've left out many, many details, but that kind of gives you a hint of one of the models, one of the creationist models. Again, there's about five or six to answer that question. But there's two main models, one by Dr. John Hartnett, and I've got his book at the back there, and another one by Dr. Russell Humphreys, that also involve relativity. And some of the other models they don't involve relativity. They've got other explanations for how we can see the light from those stars. But I'd encourage you, go to creation.com or get his, if you're really into astrophysics and so on, I'd highly recommend his book. It's a fantastic book. But thank you so much. We're going to end it here. It's, what time is it? It's about 10 to 9. And thank you so much. Tomorrow's Sunday, so we'll see you tomorrow morning. We're going to talk about evangelism and how we can evangelize a culture out there that is convinced that evolution is true. And then we're going to have a dinosaur talk for the kids at 3, is it 3:30 or 3:45? Something like that. And parents are allowed to come as well. And so if you have kids that are fascinated with dinosaurs, we're going to talk about how they fit into the Bible and some of the evidence that supports dinosaurs fitting with the Bible, not with evolution. And then tomorrow evening, we're going to talk about Noah's flood. That's our closing session tomorrow evening. The flood, what was the flood like? How violent was it? What were some of the things going on during the flood that explain the surface features of the earth that we see today? The evolutionists have explanations for them that don't fit with the Bible. How do we as Christians explain those things? That's our topic for tomorrow. So we'll see you all tomorrow. Thanks very much, and you're dismissed.